Bible Forum. Thanks so much for being here today. I want to welcome you, and my name is Russell Matthews, and today Dominic Steele will continue the series of Power, and today specifically is Power Under Pressure, and looking through the book of Daniel. And we want to welcome those. There are a few new faces out there today, and even it's surprising we had a booth down in Martin Place this past week, and where we gave out about 300 sausages and 300 different cups of coffee to people, and inviting them to come along to City Bible Forum. And there's a few of you here, so we're glad that you came all the way down from Martin Place and traveled down. For your benefit, what I'll do is I'll just kind of briefly explain to you what the City Bible Forum, what we'll be doing today, and then we'll continue on in a moment. When you arrived, hopefully you received an outline. Inside your outline, you'll find that there's a portion of the Bible here, actually on inside right of the outline. I'll be reading a portion of those verses here in a little bit. And then after that, Dominic Steele will come up and give his talk on Power Under Pressure, based out of Daniel 6. And the outline is on the left-hand side, and you're more than welcome to look through that. Write down your notes. There should be pens on the table. If you don't have a pen, we can get one of those for you. And then at the end, what you can do is fill out, there's a little white form inside of your outline that you can write down any questions that you may have for Dominic based on the talk that he has given today. And then he'll take the time to answer those within the time that we have allotted. And then hopefully we'll be out of here about 10 till. So what I'm going to do now is actually read through just a portion of the Bible that's here. I'm actually going to start at sentence number 10, so a couple paragraphs down there for you. And then we'll continue on, and Dominic will come up here and give his talk. So Daniel 6, sentence 10. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went up to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands, and in accordance with the laws of Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put into writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. When the men went as a group to the king and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the law of Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you have served, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you have served continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all of their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all of the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves, and he performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. Dominic?
Hey, look, thanks very much, Russell, and good afternoon. Nice to see you here at City Bible Forum this afternoon. If you're joining us for the first time, following the coffee and sausages and things that we had promoting the City Bible Forum, a special welcome to you. Just to introduce myself, my name's Dominic. I head up a Christian ministry called Christians in the Media. That's actually what I do when I'm not involved in the City Bible Forum. And as part of that ministry, I'm responsible for a very big conference this weekend. In fact, the moment we finish this session, I'll be hopping in the car and driving up to Penrith, and we're joined by journalists and other media workers from across Australia, but also across Southeast Asia. We've got people coming from Indonesia and from China and from Pakistan and from India and from Malaysia, and a range of them. For a weekend conference. And talking to these people, as I have been in the lead up to this conference, I've become very aware that the pressures that they face as Christian people, as a Christian in China, or as a Christian in India, or as a Christian in Pakistan, Christian in Indonesia, are very much greater than any pressure that I might face in the office here in Sydney for being Christian. And so, range of stories I've been told of muggings, of attacks, of raids on churches, real physical violence threats against people, and specifically for being Christian. And I raise that because I want us to see that the issues that we're going to deal with here in Daniel chapter 6 are live issues for people who follow Christ, for people who follow God around the world today. The issue of kind of stop worshipping God or I'll bash you. That's really the hard edge of what we're talking about today. Stop worshipping God or you'll be jailed. The persecution, though, in Australia for being Christian, for being a follower of God, it's not so much physical persecution, but there is an intimidation. Where people would feel pressure not to be Christian from what's going on around them. And people cop flack even from people knowing in the office that they're going to go to City Bible Forum or pressured not to take a stand on an issue that they think they should take a stand on because they're Christian. It's those kind of issues that we're going to be zeroing in on today. We are in the middle of 4 weeks working through the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, and in this session today, it's really the low point of Israelite history. The leading Israelites were deported from Jerusalem all the way to Babylon, and Babylon is the city they're in at the moment. This is a city that stands for rebellion against God. And until the end of chapter 5 of Daniel, the Israelites were under the jurisdiction of the Babylonian king. And then the last sentence of the last chapter, before we get to the chapter we're looking at today, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So up until now, the Babylonians have been the dominant world empire, but now Babylon has been defeated and they are dwarfed by the enormous, the great, the mighty Medo-Persian Empire. And first thing that happens is the Medo-Persian king takes the seat of authority, is office politics and anti-Semitism. And it leads to a directive from the king not to worship God. The background is the Medo-Persian kingdom is just enormous, and streamlined administration is required. You couldn't possibly administer it all straight from Babylon, and so they need to decentralize power, and the kingdom is divided up into 120 states or satrapies, and in charge of each state or satrapy is a satrap. And so Daniel chapter 6, sentence 1, it pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom. And to make sure that none of these satraps rorted their travel expenses or went to trips to the Cannes Film Festival when they should be dealing with politics back at home, three administrators were put over them, one of whom was Daniel. And I'm in verse 2, the satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. the loss that the king wants to guard against, I take it, is loss of taxes. He doesn't want the satraps to not collect the money properly. He doesn't want any of the satraps to lose the money into their pockets. But also it could have been loss in terms of part of the kingdom. He wants to make sure they're governing rightly so there's not an uprising, so there's not a rebellion. And so he puts three leaders. I take it, if you've got 120 satrapies, each leader is to supervise 40 satraps and satrapies, and Daniel is one of those three. So you've got the king and then the three sort of chief boogie-woogies under him. Now, that's a theological term. Daniel so distinguished himself amongst these administrators in verse 3 and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So Daniel was going to move from being one of those three to 2IC to the king. Now, we started Daniel when Daniel was a 17-year-old. He just arrived as a junior in Babylon. Now he's 2IC to the king of the whole of the Medo-Persian Empire. And so what happens is people start to plot and conspire against him. And so I'm in verse 4. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds and charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him. He was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. And so they conclude the only way we're going to be able to get him is by putting the knife into him over his religious commitment. And so finally, these men said, we'll never find any basis for charges against Daniel unless it's got something to do with the law of his God. So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king. They put pressure on the king. They scheme and they plot and they manipulate against Daniel, and the king is fooled into doing what he asks. And so last part of sentence 7, any god or man, anybody who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days except you, O king, be thrown in the lion's den. Now, here comes a direct request from your boss, from the boss of the Medo-Persian Empire, but it could be your boss, to not just worship him, but to stop in your heart worshipping God. This is the company wants my soul. This is the state wants my soul. This is Macquarie Bank wants my whole soul. Now, what does Daniel do? Daniel's got something more important to him than Westpac. He's got something more important to him than Korea. And this is a lesson for all of us who are surrounded by work-obsessed people. And so three times each day, what would happen? Daniel would go quietly and pray privately facing his city, Jerusalem. So Daniel's here in Babylon, and he's got a window in his office or in his room. He's closed the office door, and he looks towards Jerusalem. And I take it he looks towards Jerusalem because that is where his hope is from. He is hoping that one day God would restore the fortunes of Israel. He would be back in the kingdom would be restored. So Daniel, verse 10, learned that the decree had been published. He went home to his upstairs room, and where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he'd done before. He's living in a world, he's living in an industry opposed to God. Faced with the choice of following God and discreetly snubbing the human authority, or following the human authority and snubbing his God, he chooses to follow God, not the human authority. Most times in Australia, when there is a clash between the law of God and the law of the land, or the law of God and the demands of the company, we can kind of work out a way around it. But here, the king has brought on a challenge, and Daniel has to make a choice. And the conspirators, appears, they invade Daniel's privacy, they spy on him in his bedroom. And so 11, these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree saying that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except you, O king, would be thrown in the lion's den? The king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. I don't know if you've been thinking about this, but I've just done a little bit of research on Medo-Persian politics. Probably I'm the only person in the room who has been, but I checked it up. If you want to read a book of the Bible that has a fair bit of detail in it, it's the book of Esther. And in Esther, it's very clear. It was such a big and complex administration, the Medo-Persian Empire, that once a decree had been proclaimed, it couldn't be changed. It was aimed at stopping emotional appeals, but it was so inflexible and led to such appalling situations. And so 13, what happens? They said to the king, "Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel, made every effort until sundown to save him. There's no easy answer for the king here. It's a crazy situation. You have the king of the Medo-Persian Empire and his number one assistant set up as the enemies of law and order. The king can't see a way out. There was no choice. The law was clear. So what does he do? He has to put him to the lion's den. The king gave the order. They brought Daniel. They threw him to the lion's den. Now, lots of people know about Daniel in the lion's den. It's kind of fluffy children's story thing. Fluffy cats, cuddly, lovely. It's just beautiful. But that's not how it is in real life. We're talking real lions. Real lions who really eat meat. Real lions who'd make short business of Daniel. Well, why did the king have a lion's den in his backyard? Again, you may not have been thinking about this, but I've done a bit of research. Historical background, lion hunting in the ancient Near East was the sport of kings. And there are artworks from that period in history from the whole area, stretching from Egypt across Mesopotamia, of lion's dens. And of kings having lion's dens. Now, what happens? Sentence 17. Last half of 16, going into 17. The king prays that Daniel's God would save him. May your God, whom you serve continually, may he rescue you. Now it's fascinating. Here is an outsider, a pagan king, exercising faith. Exercising a fledgling faith in the God of Daniel. What happens is a stone is brought, placed over the mouth of the den. The king seals it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation may not be changed. It's sealed, it's firm, it's clear. We don't know what kind of night Daniel had, but we do know the king didn't sleep well. What happens is next morning, first light of dawn, the king got up, hurried to the lion's den. And this is the king of the whole of the Medo-Persian Empire. Listen to what he says about Yahweh. Listen to what he says about the God of Daniel. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God." The king of the Medo-Persian Empire sees that the God of Daniel is the living God, the true God. Has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered in 21, O king, live forever. My God sent an angel. Now let's see how this plays out. The writer of the chapter tells us in verse 23 that the king was overjoyed, that the king gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. When Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he trusted in his God. Why was Daniel saved? Because he trusted God. He trusted God, firstly, and because, secondly, he was innocent. Very interesting to know, and we touched on this last week in City Bible Forum. At the very beginning of creation, God established humanity to rule the earth under him. God said to Adam and Eve, "Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the earth, over all the living creatures that move on the earth." And his goal was that godly humanity might rule the earth rightly under God. And what's happened here in the middle of the night is God's man Daniel, godly Daniel, faithful Daniel, trusting Daniel, has managed to subdue the beasts, to rule the earth rightly under God. Significantly, not so the ungodly conspirators against Daniel. So we look at 24, at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Daniel says to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel. My God did it. He shut the mouths of lions. The one who saved me is Yahweh." And Daniel is rightfully thankful to Yahweh for saving him. "They have not hurt me. because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I done anything wrong before you, O king. Two reasons that Daniel was saved. One, he trusted God, and two, he was innocent. King says, well, I'm going to tell everyone. I'm going to address the nations. And that is what the king does. He addresses the nations. And so here in 26, the king says, to the whole of the Medo-Persian Empire, I'm going to tell you about Daniel's God. He is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. What are the take-home messages for us as we head back to the factory this afternoon? First message is that God rescues those who have faith in him. We see this in Daniel refusing to stop praying to Yahweh. Daniel continually expressing his trust and dependence in Yahweh. Daniel looking to Jerusalem from where God would rescue. You see it play out in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul writes to the Christian church in Thessalonica in Greece. And writing to the Christian church in Thessalonica, the Apostle Paul says, the Lord's message rang out from you. Not only in Macedonia and Achaia, your faith, your trust in God, Daniel's trust in God, has become known everywhere. Therefore, we don't need to say anything about it. They themselves tell what kind of reception you gave us. They tell how you, one, turned to God from idols. Daniel had a choice, idol or God. Am I going to follow the way of the Babylonians, follow the way of the Medo-Persians, or am I going to serve God? Am I going to follow the way of everybody else in the office, or am I going to serve God? They tell how you turn to God from idols to serve the true and living God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. There's lots and lots and lots of people out there in the world who will tell you, here is what a Christian is. Lots and lots of interpretations of what a Christian is, what somebody who is God's person is. But if you want to know what a Christian is, here is what God says a Christian is. God says a Christian is somebody who has turned from idols. They no longer worship the company. They no longer worship careerism. They no longer worship materialism. They no longer worship any of those idols. They have turned from idols to serve the true and living God. And wait. Daniel's got his eyes looking to Jerusalem, looking for the rescue, longing for God to rescue. The rescue, the deliverance, the salvation that Daniel's longing for, it ultimately comes in Jesus. In Jesus coming and dying on the cross. And so Paul can write post-Jesus of the true Christian and say, the true Christian waits for Jesus, waits for the Son of God from heaven, whom God raised from the dead, Jesus who rescues us from the coming wrath. A Christian is not somebody who's going to really, 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 really good person. That's not a Christian. A Christian is someone who is rescued, who turned, who trusts, who serves. Daniel, saved from the jaws of the lions. The wrath that we are saved from, we can be saved from. It's the coming wrath. It's the jaws of hell. It's impressive being saved from a lion, much more significant to be saved from the coming wrath. And so at that point, I got to stop and say, is that you? Every week in City Bible Forum, about a third of the people here, people here who kind of come along from the office and they're just kind of kicking the tires, checking out what it is to have a relationship with God, what it is to be a genuine Christian. And you might be that person here today, not sure whether you are. Well, you've heard the definition now. The question is, are you going to be a turn person? Are you going to be a serving person? Are you going to be a person whose life is dominated by waiting for the Lord Jesus? And you're prepared to stand for turn, served, wait, again, when the whole rest of the company, the whole rest of the CBD is going in the opposite direction, just like it was in Babylon. How does it play out in the office this week? Well, Daniel's faith is held up to us in the Central Business District as a model to encourage us to keep trusting God and to so trust that we would be rescued. Daniel rescued from the lion's den. Not even the most powerful king in the world, the Medo-Persian king. He couldn't save Daniel, yet the Lord rescued Daniel. Should I imitate Daniel's faith? The New Testament tells me to. Look with me in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11 from verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell. After the people had marched around them 7 days, by faith the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, who shut the mouth of lions. When you see a mighty act of God, like God allowing a human man to spend a night in a lion's den alive, when you see a mighty God act so spectacularly like that, that he shut the mouth of lions, how should I react? You keep reading in Hebrews, and he says these people, Barak, Jephthah, David, Samuel, they were commended for their faith. Daniel commended for his faith. Daniel held up as a role model for us, and yet there is an even better example that we should look to. We should look for a moment at the faith of Daniel. That is amazing. I want to trust God like that. I want to be a person who's turned from idols like that. But something better is held up to us. Next verse of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 12. Fix your eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorned its shame, sat down at the right hand of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. I got to look at the example of Daniel and the way he put his faith in God, and then I get pointed to an even greater example, the example of the Lord Jesus, and not grow weary. Here in Daniel 6, the godly man Daniel will not stop worshipping the true and living God, and won't worship the gods of the Babylonians, the gods of the Medo-Persians. The rulers of Australia, they haven't asked us to stop worshipping God. I mean, there's all sorts of legislation that nibbles around the edges, that some of the stuff in the Anti-Discrimination Act. But really, it's a tea party compared to the pressure that a Christian in China gets. And a couple of the people I'm going to be meeting up with this afternoon. It's a tea party compared to the pressure that the Christian in Indonesia gets. It's a tea party compared to the pressure that a Christian in India, in under Hindu-dominated India, gets. The hard edge of this chapter does come in some parts of the world, particularly in the Muslim-dominated countries. But for those of us who live in Australia, it doesn't often come down to the state says don't and God says do. Usually, it's not that kind of persecution. Usually, it's much more subtle. I don't know, you've heard the story of the frog. Scientists put a live frog in a saucepan, cold water. Frog thinks this is nice, I can jump out any time I like. And then they turn the gas on. And the frog thinks this is a nice warm bath. I can jump out any time I like. And it's just very pleasant and very relaxed. And the gas gets slightly hotter. And the frog doesn't even notice until he's boiled frog. And it's just so gradual and so seductive. the way I get dragged away from clarity on the things of God. A friend of mine, been out of uni for a couple of years, joined us here in the CBD in the corporate sector. Somebody in the office knew he was Christian and asked him a question in front of a few others, and he just had one of those seminal moments. It was the first time in this organisation that he'd been asked to stand for his faith. And he said, I didn't know how to handle the question. I didn't know how to cope with the conversation. I didn't know what to say. And for him it was a seminal moment, because last year at uni he would have been absolutely clear. And he said it was a seminal moment, Dominic, because the water around me had got hotter and I hadn't noticed. And I'm just saying this to you, he said, because I know unless I do something now, then I fear for where I'll be in 5 years' time. Friends, I want to say, look to Daniel as our model. But even more, consider him the author and perfecter of our faith. Consider the Lord Jesus, so that we will not grow weary and lose heart as we wait for him from heaven who comes to rescue from the coming wrath. Now, there's questions and comments in a moment, but I'll hand back to Russell.
So, Dominic, I'll turn this back to you.
I've got two questions here. Both really relate to the book of Hebrews that I quoted at the end. Somebody has asked, is it fair to say that even when we put our faith in God wholeheartedly, he may not always rescue us from the lion's den, but he will rescue us from the coming wrath, and that should be our hope? Certainly, I'd want to say that if you put your faith in Jesus, you will be rescued from the coming wrath. I think that is absolutely clear from 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 that we looked at a moment ago. Say, will I always be rescued from my, if you like, the lion's den that I'm facing in life today? I'm facing a stressful situation, and some say that's my lion's den. Somebody could say that. You've got to know that there's a passage, and it'd be worth reading this passage later on, Hebrews chapter 12. To keep reading Hebrews 12, and in Hebrews 12 there is a section where the writer of the letter, the Hebrews, speaks about how God disciplines his children, and God in disciplining his children, my boy did the wrong thing this week. On Monday he spent 45 minutes dilly-dallying over getting home from school, and supposed to be home from school at 3:10. Walked in at 3:50 because he'd been playing footy carts. And he's not supposed to do that after school, and so he got grounded and missed a trip to McDonald's that night. Now, he was talking to me about this harsh punishment from his mother. And he said, I just don't think she loves me. And I explained to Solomon that if she didn't love him, she wouldn't care if he got home or didn't get home. It was because she loved him that she disciplined him. And he was actually able to see this because one of his friends went missing 2 weeks before, and for an hour or so after school, and his mum was frantic, and my wife was involved in with her driving around the inner west looking, and they finally found him, and this boy's mum said, I'm going to kill him. And I said to Solomon, do you think your friend's mum loves her boy? And she said, oh yeah, he loves her boy. But she was going to punish him. Oh yeah. And he was actually able to see that love would lead to discipline. Now, there's all sorts of things that God disciplines me in. You see it in Hebrews. And endure hardship, Hebrews 12, verse 7, is discipline. God is treating you as sons. For what son is not disciplined by his father? If you're not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're illegitimate children and are not true sons. Moreover, we've all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good. So I think you can see that sometimes we have difficulties and God is disciplining us. And one of the reasons, one of the things that I would ask, if something's going wrong in my life, is there something that God is disciplining me for? Now, there may be, there may not be. It may be there for another reason. But certainly, that is a possibility. That's the answer to question one. The second issue is, Hebrews says, killed for disobedience. Is this true? And if yes, is it applicable today for Christians? I was thinking killed for disobedience, and the only place that I could think of that idea in Hebrews was Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26. If we deliberately keep on sinning after we've received knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. Anyone who rejected the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much more severely do you think a man deserves to be punished who's trampled the Son of God underfoot? And I think the point there is, if you reject the rescue, the one who rescues us from the coming wrath, then there is a judgment, and it's worse than the lions. And that's harsh. Well, that's hard, but it's true. And it's better to know than not know. It's better to know the sharks in the water than to go swimming not knowing the sharks in the water. Jesus comes to rescue us from the coming wrath. Implicit in that is there is a coming wrath. We need to hang on to the rescuer. Hey, next week, Russell will wrap in a moment, but next week it's Daniel 7. If Daniel 6 is the best known chapter in the Bible for children's stories, Daniel 7, I think, is one of the most important chapters in the whole of the Old Testament. If I was put on a desert island for the rest of my life and I was allowed to take 8 chapters of the Bible with me, Daniel 7 would be one of them. It's one of the key chapters for understanding the whole plot line of the Bible, and it's ours, 1 o'clock next Thursday. I hope you can be here.
Thank you so much, Dominic. Well, thank you for coming along today. Please come back next week for Power and the Future. Thank you.